This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This project for me and the sort of considerations of modernism and injury and injury as a modernist principle begin with a passage from a letter that Kafka wrote to a friend in 1904. Aber es tut gut, wenn das Gewissen breite Wunden bekommt, denn dadurch wird es empfindlicher für jeden Biss. Ich glaube, man sollte überhaupt nur solche Bücher lesen, die einen beißen und stechen. Wenn das Buch, das wir lesen, uns nicht mit einem Faustschlag auf den Schädel weckt, wozu lesen wir dann das Buch? All right, I've earned my paycheck from the German department. And for the non-German speakers in the room, here's the translation. But it's good for the conscience to suffer gaping wounds, as this makes it more sensitive to every twinge. I think we should only read the kinds of books that sting and stab. If the book we're reading doesn't wake us with a blow to the head, then what are we reading it for? So here the aspiring author has proclaimed a kind of literary violence to come. Good writing, contends Kafka, should work to wound its audience, as it's only with the aim of being wounded that one should read at all. As readers, he insists, we ought to seek those books that sting and stab, and the language in the original German here is even more resonant, beißen, to bite, and stechen, not only stab in the sense of a stabbing pain, but stab as a knife stabs or to sting as a bee stings. The purpose of literature, it appears, is the infliction of pain, and the sensation of the suffering is also its own raison d'être, the enhancement of our sensitivity to every twinge, as he puts it. This, then, is Kafka's brutal reinscription of an old aestheticist tautology. L'art pour l'art has been transformed into an injury purely for the sake of injury. And if this early letter can be understood as a miniature literary manifesto, in it the author espouses both an artistic method and a manner of interpretation, what I would call an aesthetic of injury and an aesthetics of injury, respectively. The inauguration of a new era of aesthetic sensibility, and one for which this capacity to leave deep wounds constitutes the key criterion of literary success. If the experience of reading he prescribes is a painful one, implicitly he also advocates an authorial technique that would operate injuriously to awaken its reader with a blow to the head. Plainly put, he designates the wound as the ideal model for the variety of readerly reception he desires to provoke, or rather to inflict. And this is this notion of the wound, or the text as inflicting wounds, not only describing wounds in its reader. My initial inclination many years ago, when this project was in its infancy, was more or less to celebrate this aesthetic model and then call it a day. As I put it in the book's opening lines, that an artwork ought to injure is among the most fundamental and the most resilient of modernist tenets. Implicit in an avant-garde injunction to formal provocation and iconoclasm are a fascination and an affinity with violence. Not pounds make it new, but rather make it hurt, that persists throughout the 20th and into the present century. Originally, I just thought I'd sort of excavate this tendency in modernist literature, give a few particularly striking examples. There are plenty, and I'm sure that many will come up today. And that would more or less be that. Kafka's letter ends, for instance, with the relatively well-known pronouncement that a book should be the axe for the frozen sea within. Ein Buch muss die Axt sein für das gefrorene Meer in uns. When in his 1917 Ein Landarzt, a country doctor, the boy's wound is said in passing to have been inflicted by an axe, I thought we could relatively uncritically read this as the consummation of the literary aesthetic philosophy that Kafka espouses in his earlier epistle. But something kept bothering me, and that's what the book became about. If Kafka's aesthetic paradigm would seem to suggest that a book behaved like an injury, there were other moments, and I'm thinking clearly of the penal colony here, where there's a writing machine that inscribes text as wounds into the reader's body or into the victim's or condemned man's body, where wounding itself seemed to be a kind of text. The filmic and literary wounds I examine in aesthetics of injury more often than not short-circuit this way. Representing the text as wound and the wound in turn as text, they reveal themselves to be inescapably self-referential. At the same time, the opposition between these vectors, wound to text and text to wound, makes the textual wound itself into a figure of difference, of deferral and ceaseless mediation. what at first blush might seem the most violently immediate of topoi thus turns out to be one of the most inexorably and vexingly discursive. Rather than a celebration, then, of sort of modernist wounding, ultimately I attempted to expose and to deconstruct this aesthetic of injury as one of the foundational mythologies of 20th century narrative, from Baudelairean and Kafkaian modernism to the more postmodern or postmodernist concerns of 2004 Nobel laureate of Elfriede Jelinek and the acclaimed but controversial filmmakers Michael Haneke and Quentin Tarantino. My central claim, just to highlight it right there, is that inasmuch as it consists of a corporeal inscription, the wound, which serves as an idealized aesthetic model for all seven authors and three filmmakers under consideration in the book, is itself a kind of text, working chronologically through an idiosyncratic canon, as Naomi listed them one more time for good measure, Charles Baudelaire, Franz Kafka, Georges Bataille, Jean Genet, Lin Sixou, Ingeborg Bachmann, Elfriede Jelinek, Werner Schröte, Michael Haneke, and Quentin Tarantino, and then a tiny little bit of Reinhold Goetz. An Aesthetics of Injury explores the consequences of this tautological narrative model, or textual model, not only for the history of narrative thought, or for the history of narrative thought, which is to say both the narratological workings of these texts, how they tell stories, and the underlying epistemology this reveals, whether these storytellers, whether these narrativists still believe in narrative at all. Well, the texts treated range from poetry to prose to cinema. They thus nonetheless share a certain number of defining structural traits. I mean then for the narrative wound of my subtitle, not only to refer to the content of these texts, but also to serve as a generic distinction, or a sort of quasi-generic distinction, like the fragment, or the prose poem, or autobiography, or pornography, or at the very least as a sort of label for this set of common textual strategies. And I'll list those here. There are three. Number one, the class of texts I refer to as the narrative wound not only depicts wounds, but also aims to inflict injury. The wound is not only the subject of the texts that are treated in the book, but it's also their literary and filmic form, narrative wound really as a genre. Two, like the wound itself, these texts are structurally unstable. Compositionally, they're extraordinarily labile, apt to be read in ever-varying order, prone to fragmentation and perpetual reconstitution. And that's a phenomenon that I define as decadence. I take two sort of 19th century terms, decadence and asceticism, and update them into the 20th century. And so decadence, I take this from Paul Bourget, is this notion of the text being deconstructed into ever smaller narrative components that are apt to then be rearranged. And then finally, there's the aspect that I dub aestheticism. Due to the illocutionary aspiration of the quasi-genre of the narrative wound, its dual function as a depiction and an infliction of injury, these texts trouble tidy differentiations between signifying registers and what is signified, most often through a conflation or reversal of the literal and the metaphorical. And I won't talk about that too much here, but that's one of the main thrusts of the book. If narratologically these self-fragmenting texts profoundly uproot linear storytelling, semiologically their self-recursivity troubles the structure of signification as such. At issue is the precarious, mutually independent, interdependent relationship between reality and its verbal or visual representation. Increasingly, over the historical arc the book describes, rather than representing a pre-existing reality, the literary and filmic wounds that are examined begin to constitute their own reality, and I should maybe put reality there in scare quotes. Injury begins to serve, as I phrase it, especially in my final chapters, as an ersatz for immediate experience. And it's this ontological movement from or between immediacy and its ersatz that concerns me in the book. Beyond well-established filiations, standard pairings of Genet and Sixou, for instance, or Bachmann and Jelinek, and obvious oppositions, Haneke and Tarantino, are often opposed in the scholarship, I've tried to use this lens to establish, as I put it, a sort of idiosyncratic canon. And there are a lot of borrowings and explicit allusions between the texts, but I don't think that these authors are often all treated in the same study. Exposing the sometimes hidden heritage, I hope to highlight the crucial but rather neglected role that an aesthetic of injury has played throughout literary and filmic modernism into the postmodern. Not that no one ever speaks of violence in modernism, but not quite in this way. As the book progresses, the wound then takes on meaning not only as a trope or topos, but more broadly as a narratological category, intimately linked to phenomena of literary decadence and asceticism, gains force as an affect of political or psychological harm. It's revealed as a site of narrative disintegration, as the trace of a poetics of omission, and as a structural analog to the filmic cut. As a lens into literature and cinema and aesthetics of injury allows me to intervene in the most stubborn of interpretive debates, castration and Mataille, écriture féminine and Cixous and Bachmann, while sort of shifting, or violence in Haneke and Tarantino, while shifting these in new and often unexpected directions. I try and remain attuned throughout to the violence inherent in signification itself, attempting to develop a model of close reading that operates to break down individual texts and larger corpora into their constituent parts, rearranging these into fresh and then freshly signifying constellations. So just quickly to the structure of the book, and then I will shut up and let Jean-Michel and Nora talk. The book's divided into three parts, the first of which is confusingly called An Aesthetic of Injury, so about their aesthetic, their writerly aesthetic, and not my sort of readerly approach, which seeks to ground the study historically and to establish its two chief concerns, what I've just defined or redefined as decadence and aestheticism. Defining these terms structurally as well as thematically, I endeavored to trace the importance of these literary historical categories, conventionally more closely associated with the 19th century, into and throughout the 20th. By decadence, just to repeat, I mean the decomposition of the artwork into ever briefer compositional elements. And it's this fragmentation and perpetual rearrangement that constitutes the sort of narrative component of the aesthetic of injury. An attentiveness to this aesthetic reveals that it's not so much the case that narrative decays over the course of the century, and its course from modernism to the postmodern, as that we're faced with an alternate mode of storytelling, generated precisely by its own decadence and decomposition. With regard to cinematic texts, for instance, I examine the key syntactical element, the filmic cut, as both a narrative wound, in the sense that it ineluctably injures narrative by severing and fragmenting cinematic images, but also as a narrative wound, which narrativizes these images by arranging them into a montage, into an overarching storyline that's complete despite its fragmentation. And this isn't just in film. I find this in Kafka's comic splices, for instance, or in other sort of comparable literary syntactical structures. The book's second section, The Poetics of Omission, highlights two additional elements of this injurious aesthetic procedure, autobiography and eroticism. Every wound, every key wound that's treated in the book is in some sense sexualized and quite often obscenely so, and so the obscene becomes an aspect that's worthy of discussion. But perhaps more significantly, the wound is intended. If the wound is intended as the site of an encounter with the real, then it is by necessity inextricably involved with an author's own actual lived experience. The literary wound thus becomes a trace or a scar, attesting to the author's efforts to alchemize their own autobiography into an artwork. At stake in what I call a poetics of omission isn't only the absence of certain passages from the published text, things that were too intimate to their authors, for instance, to warrant being left in the text, but the absence of corporeal reality from the textual symbolic. For the authors and filmmakers who practice an aesthetic of injury, the artwork itself is, by its very nature, a scar denoting absence. And yet, as over the course of the time period covered by this study, what we tend to think of as the most stable of reference, the human body, becomes increasingly indistinguishable from its function as text. Injury becomes a supplement for the reality perceived to be lacking. And it's this supplemental structure of the wound that's the subject of the book's final section, which I call the filmic cut, in part for the reasons I just explained. The inclusion of the filmic medium, and this is where I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts, Nora, adds another dimension to the question of aestheticism, since the ontological circumstances of cinema oblige it to an actual representation, oftentimes qua reproduction of physical reality. The most important question probed in these chapters is how one can achieve authenticity in an entirely mediated reality once this possibility of reality writ large has been revoked. In part because of this postmodern risk of derealization, my examination takes an at times quite critical stance toward the aesthetic paradigm it endeavors to expose. Like the notions of aestheticism and decadence employed here, the wound of the title, as I've already insisted, I think, is both thematic, what these texts represent, and structural, how they conceive of representation. These are works intended by their authors to be wounding, but they are also all wounded narratives in both their formal breakdown, decadence, and in their perilous conflation of the literary and the real, what I call aestheticism. The persistence, even today, of an aesthetic of injury can in part be attributed to the fact that it consists of its own deconstruction. Tautological in this way, it's particularly difficult to demythologize. Central to my investigation is the question of how the literary wound, once the modernist emblem par excellence of a metaphysics of presence, of an immediate aesthetic experience, becomes implicated in the kind of quasi-deconstructionist postmodern mediated reality for which no hors-texte can exist. Or to speak anachronistically with Nietzsche, but I think maybe more clearly, how the real world becomes a fable. My epilogue then examines this in Tarantino, and I won't get into that, but just because I really needed an example of someone who can be rather cleanly cast as postmodern in a way that neither Jelinek or Haneke can. Essentially, then, in Aesthetics of Injury, I ask what happens if, instead of understanding the persistence of corporeal authentication as an aesthetic strategy and a guiding epistemological principle, despite the postmodern bodies having been discursivized, we recognize, as I insist throughout the study, that it's nothing other than this constant recourse to corporeal authentication, to an aesthetic of injury, that discursivizes the body to begin with. The book charts how a modernist insistence on the irrefutable reality of the wound, initially an aesthetic strategy, comes to provoke just such an epistemological, ontological crisis, and ultimately how this same aesthetic paradigm attempts to cope with the injured sense of being it has inflicted. It might be in the nature of this kind of project, or of writing a book, or putting one's opinions down in print generally, that when it's finished, it feels less like an accomplishment than a liability. But ultimately, I'm hopeful that some of these conceptual categories might have traction and gain currency and be useful for an examination of literary and cinematic figures beyond this weird canon that I've constructed. But that will be up for others to decide. And so with that, I turn it over to Jean-Michel and Nora, and they can tell me whether this thing has any legs. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ian. I'd say first, this is not just hype, but genuine praise, that I love reading that book. That not only is it well written, I think one can say that, it sounds a little old fashioned, but it is well written. And it captures something that, as I think as most original books, makes you see something that was there that you didn't think of it in those terms. And this is what you invent, the aesthetics of the wound. We will try to query it and question it, but you make it come alive as such. And that's quite remarkable. So really, for a first book, the sense of seasoned writer doing it. And since Naomi mentioned my recent work with Kafka, I'll begin with the Kafka section. Like you, I've always been fascinated by that famous letter of 1904, so strong and a little surprising when we think of Kafka. You know, you could imagine this with sort of very late romantic writer, Strindberg, but Kafka, I think, what, wounding us and so on? I'll say that this is the German, Viennese, Habsburg side of your book that is interesting. I'll say simply that here at Slot, we know about this. I imagine, so he begins his book with this amazing story of a young writer, and I hope you all watch this on YouTube, Reinhard Goetz, who, very handsome young man, in a reading, I hadn't seen it, reads his text and then take a razor blade and slashes his forehead, and then continues reading full of blood. We showed similar scenes here at Slot more than 10 years ago, maybe Nora will remember, when we had our series on Viennese actionism. We had Hermann Nietzsche here, For Nietzsche, we had to acquire special curtains. The university and everyone wanted us to prevent poor students from being shocked by films that showed blood. In those films, there were the recent film, but the earlier Nietzsche film, people would cut themselves. We also showed the series with Günter Bruce. And I have to say, I don't know whether you know Günter Bruce, but some of his videos are really hard to watch because you see him going against a sort of table with blades, and he's obviously suffering and trying to overcome it, and he's bleeding, and you see the blood, and you know it's not faked, and so on. So there is something that regularly in action videos, or all those American artists who, you know, were shot at or crucified and so on, is something we wanted to show. And there's always a certain limit that you wonder whether you can cross. What can you show? What will you not show? But what I liked is that your book is not only about film and that, but also about literature, and that's quite successful. And so to begin, I'll just ask a few questions and maybe you'll want to answer. Not, I'll ask them all at once and you'll see. But to go back to Kafka as such, I've always been surprised by the text you discuss, this country doctor who sees a boy who has a wound full of maggots and you don't really know what's happening. It's very mysterious. In my book, I worked a lot on a very early text, description of a struggle, Beschreibung eines Kampfes. And at the end, you have the friend of the narrator who stabs himself with a penknife, but bleeds a lot. You don't really know why. It's something that remains enigmatic. And this is my first question. Is this really something that is so serious, or is it not at times, at least if we think of description of a struggle, something that belongs a little more to the genre of the grotesque? See, a sort of excessive grotesque that would be. And so I'm led to that question because of your work on Baudelaire and a book I just reread recently, and I had read it a long time ago and completely forgotten it, Mario Pras, 1931 or 32, book on the devil, flesh, and decadence in Europe. Traces a sort of, at least for people like me and you who are interested in modernism, a very interesting lineage between Baudelaire mostly, Sade, he goes back to Sade, so a lot about Sade and not only being wounded but wounding people, inflicting pain and so on, and modernism somehow. And so this is the second question, and this question would have something to do with some etymological remarks, because I noted, I went back to, and often you always have the French text. There's not to boast of French being a more subtle language, but for once, French is richer in the sense that French has two words for the wound, blessure, plaie. Okay, and in Baudelaire, at times it is blessure, at times it is play. I tried, and that's a real question. Is there like a logic to the distribution, the semantic distribution? Whereas, you know, English and German have the same word, one can say. Wunde, wound, same word. They all are related to the idea of striking, hurting somebody, and so on. But if you know French, you will know that we can say of somebody, quelle plaie, meaning this is a disaster, this person, not quelle blessure. You cannot say that. And blessé usually means really actively penetrate, cut the skin, and plaie can be something that comes from within. So I don't know whether this is part of your meaning, but my question would be here more about something that would rethink the idea of the trauma. Because trauma, if we are in the purely semantic field, as you know, trauma means wound in Greek as well. So all these wounds, some wounds don't close and others scar. And so all those writers, filmmakers, leave the wound open, which is what you really focus on, when the wound is still there. So is that a better way of thinking trauma studies, maybe a field that has played itself out and has become really in play? I mean, boring, the boring trauma studies, you know, always the same text and so on. Rethought in terms of something that I would be tempted to say is your allegory. It's a Benjaminian allegory. I don't know whether you would agree with that. And finally, I was so happy you mentioned Hélène Cixous' text on Genet that I hadn't read in a long time. She was my supervisor a very long time ago. And I saw how well she understood the wound in Genet, and it seemed to me that indeed Genet is a great, not only because of what Derrida has done in GLA with the idea of castration and so on, and you work a lot with that, but also, and I guess you mentioned that in passing, what's seemed to me the key of Genet's latest text, Un Captif Amoureux, in which he disappears, as it were, in a hole in the house of this Palestinian friend. And so the wound is almost a regressive. So the last question is your link with psychoanalysis, which is a big question. But do you see the wound as a sort of regressive return to the uterus, or is that too heavy-handed?
Let me take them in reverse order, because the last one is the simplest. The link with psychoanalysis, none, essentially. Which is to say that especially when it comes to the themes of castration, and I think I mentioned this in a kind of series of footnotes that are sporadically or endnotes placed at the end of the book, so you can find the little castration Easter eggs. But with... You knew it was going to be bad. But with Kafka, you know, starting from Kafka and then Bataille, and especially Cixous and Genet, well, especially Cixous, let's say, and then Jelinek, when castration comes up, it's as a Freudian theory. And so Jelinek, for instance, is parodying castration. So to take castration as a sort of hermeneutic model toward the text is really just repeating what's, and I'm not the first person to have argued this, but it's really just repeating the work that the text already does. So I kind of tried to bracket it out. It's impossible to thoroughly bracket out, because it's in not only the background, but it's at the forefront of so many of these texts. But it didn't seem like it was going to deliver much other than taking the whole manuscript, you know, the whole book in a different direction. It would have to be a book about castration to thoroughly deal with that. The way that you phrased the trauma question is a lot more interesting to me. You know, in terms of the sort of psychoanalytic link, because I spent a lot of time in the early years of working on this insisting that actually I don't want it to be about trauma, thinking that that might be what it turned out to be about in the beginning. And it's partly because I wanted to be more literal about it. And that kind of gets at your question about blessure and play, and that especially... On the one hand, you could look at that as the same sort of distinction between injury and wound that we have in English, or Verletzung and Wunde that we have in German, and yet play is all the more concrete in a way. And yet you wouldn't describe trauma as a blessure, you'd describe it as a play. And I think that was one of the nicest descriptions that I've heard in a very long time, this notion that some wounds don't close. And I think the reason that, I don't know if you could find a new model for trauma studies or a way of waking up trauma studies, which is, as you say, played out a little bit and maybe become a bit dormant in recent years. It wasn't what I was attempting to do, but maybe there might be some way to push it in that direction. And I think the takeaway would be that modernism poses a problem for trauma, because it's against a sort of narrative model of memory. If you look at the kind of mémoire involontaire that you have in Proust, or the kinds of shock memories that you have in Baudelaire, they want these to be wounds that don't close. And so the idea of it being unhealthy because it's left open or because it still hurts, and then it needs to sort of be, you know, talking cured away, would be anathema, I think, to a lot of the sort of modernist structures. And then the last question, the grotesque, and especially the grotesque as a kind of humor, I find really interesting because it is that pen wound, for instance, that then comes back up in Bataille, the stabbing of the hand. You don't know, it almost reads like a joke. And so much of Kafka, even if not especially these most brutal parts, are also the funniest. The wound, the particular wound in the boy's side, what I really love about that moment is that when he mentions the axe, it's as a figure of speech. It's almost as if this, and it's clearly not a figure of speech that we tend to use on a daily basis, but he says, oh, your wound, like all others, was made by an axe in the wood that you didn't hear coming. And then it becomes very literal. And it's this literalization of the idiomatic that is key to Kafka in general, but is one of the structures that comes then back up again in Bachmann and Jelinek, especially in the sort of German part of the tradition. If, you know, going back to Sade and then Baudelaire and Bataille is the sort of one axis, this aesthetic of evil, then the other one is this sort of literalization of the idiomatic or of the metaphorical that we find in Kafka, and that becomes a sort of repeated structure in German language letters throughout the century. Thank you.
We can ask more of one. Okay. Is this on? So I just want to sort of reaffirm what Jean-Michel said about it was a real pleasure to read this text for so many reasons, and also having the three languages running through it was really wonderful, and it's rare to be able
there
to do that.
There are translations, I should.
Yeah, and your translations and the other translations are great. What I really liked and enjoyed about reading this was that it was so suggestive, and it made me think of many other things, as was noted when we met earlier, and everyone just started flying at you like, have you seen this? Have you read this? What about this and that? And I think that's really the testimony of a good text, is that it makes one think, and it makes one think about many other issues. But to try not to go off on my own ramblings and associations, but to bring it to the text. So I was thinking, since my assignment was film, to kind of come back to that moment of the cut, and thinking of Buñuel's Chien Andalou from 1928, where you have, in a way, the first cut, which also relates, I think, to this one phrase you said on page 5, that the cut is the simultaneous literalization of the metaphorical and concomitantly the metaphorization of the real. So you've got this double movement going, and that becomes literalized in that Buñuelian cut, because he achieves the cut, the slicing of the eye, through the filmic cut. So it is both. And then I was trying to, as I was pondering this, I was sort of wondering, well, it's 1928 and it's what without sound. And I was thinking then about when you're writing about Tarantino, and you remind us of those 1970s pop songs that he includes on the soundtrack. And thinking about that disjunctive sort of happy melody of Caught in the Middle Again or Stuck in the Middle Again and other soundtracks, which is a little like Clockwork Orange's Singing in the Rain. And then wondering if there is that disjuncture then, and that sound, the oral and the image disjuncture is also like a cut. And if you could say a little bit more about that. So that would be one question, an observation.
And you thought that sound wasn't going to come up. She was asking me to theorize the notion of the sonic cut.
Okay. Well, there you go. Well, people know me that I have this like sound fetish, so I always look at sound. So that was one question that I had. And another one was when I was, again, thinking about film and trying to think, you know, what films are there cuts? And since recently we had a Chris Marker event here, so I had to rethink about Chris Marker. And at one point, Marker had said that for him, in both Les Statues Meurent Aussi, Statues Also Die from 53 that he did with Alain René, as well as later on in Sans Soleil, that for him, the post-colonial or the colonial trauma was in the cut to the animal. So in Statues Meurent Aussi, it's with the disemboweling of the gorilla. And in Sunless or Sans Soleil, it's with the giraffe that's shot and cut. And then I was thinking about another Haneke film, which you don't discuss here, but we just talked about. In Cachet, you have that cutting of the head of the rooster, and so the blood there. And so I was just wondering how the cut, and this would link to trauma, becomes can also be seen in different contexts as a sort of the post-colonial cut, as that moment, that slicing, but a displacement onto the animal and not onto the human body. And what happens when the cut isn't on the human subject, but is on an animal subject? Yeah. So that would be question number two.
As it were. I think that Cachet is definitely the place to look at that, because that cut is then repeated on the body of a person who's sort of insisting on this element to his narrative. And it's very interesting for Haneke. People think of Haneke as an extremely graphic filmmaker, but it's not necessarily the case. That's one of the few sort of open wounds, you know, it's a gash in the throat that we insistently have to watch, and that he's insisting that we have to watch, that it not be displaced, I guess, you know, to sort of take the paradigm that you're establishing, to not be displaced onto the animal, but to say, no, this is about me and this is what it looks like, and you're going to have to confront, you know, what you've done or what you're responsible for. I like that. That really makes me rethink that scene. In terms of the filmic cut, the Buñuel is partly where this notion of the filmic cut and the way that I'm describing it, I get from Patrick French, who's a Bataille scholar. Odd to sort of take a notion of a filmic cut from the work on Bataille, but he's describing at that moment the Buñuel, and it's exactly as you put it, that the cut is both metaphorical and literal, and is the one that makes the other happen. I'm not sure what to do with the sound in Tarantino. Lisa Coulthard talks about that sequence as a sort of forcing. She talks in terms of Zizekian interpassivity, and she says this forces us to enjoy the violence in a way that, because the music is so peppy and so infectiously, you know, happy, that it puts us in a sort of sadistic position, that we sort of sit back and we kind of passively but sadistically enjoy the violence. I don't know if everyone knows the scene, but he plays Stuck in the Middle Is With You on the radio, and he dances along to it, and then he cuts off this cop's ear in a rather brutal way. But while that might be a way of... Well, let me start here. Tarantino often describes his own violence as dance numbers. He talks about, you know, this is just like a dance number in a musical. You might not like that, that might not be your thing, but that's just a matter of taste. Don't worry about it. There is no substance to this kind of violence in film, so basically get off my back. And there are, you know, the dance sequences, for instance, which really are dance sequences in, say, Kill Bill, where that might be fair. Stuck in the Middle With You, that sequence from Reservoir Dogs is a little bit more interesting, because that's still when Tarantino is insisting on this violence that's going to hurt us as an audience, that's what makes him a good filmmaker, essentially, is that he can make this film hurt. And that ambiguity sticks around until I think of Django Unchained, for instance, where you've got the slave being ripped apart by dogs, and that's supposed to ground this as a serious commentary on slavery. You know, Tarantino clearly thinks of this as the best film and the only serious film that's ever been made on slavery. But then there's the shootout at the end, and the whole house goes up in fireworks, and then it's just pure fun. And don't get on his case if you find it too violent, because clearly it's just a joke at this point. And he has trouble sort of sustaining that. And it would be interesting, you're making me think about it sort of afresh, to look back now at that sequence in Reservoir Dogs and wonder what's going on with the music and the way that this sort of complicates our spectatorial position vis-a-vis the violence.
Since we're talking about Tarantino, I think that, just to mention The Hateful Eight,
yeah,
that what's interesting is that amidst all the incredibly gory, bloody visual scenes, one of the most troubling is where a lot of people, where you're just sort of squirming, is when he's telling the story, which is a pure imaginary story, about meeting what he did to the Southern Colonel's son, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're just listening to it, and that, I mean, it makes you squirm. So that what makes one squirm then isn't what you see, but what you hear,
yeah,
right? That narrative, and just when we imagine what has happened,
yeah,
which is, I thought was an interesting moment in that film. But I want to thank you, though, for writing about Tarantino, because it did redeem that film slightly for me.
Oh, really?
Only slightly.
I mean, the thing about Tarantino is that if you take the sort of odd and modernist model of a text as a mousetrap, he really knows how to do that. And he's really, you know, into generic satisfaction, for instance. And at it's at moments like that where the story is told and filmed in a certain way where it's not even shown, and that's the bit that's making you squirm the most, where you recognize his talent as a filmmaker. I wish that the conversation would get steered away a little bit more from other aspects, but yeah.
Well, since you've invited me to comment, and since you know some of my work, obviously connected to The Cut, you know that I've written a bit about amputation.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about amputations, and having recently watched both the 2017 Sofia Coppola's Beguiled, as well as the Clint Eastwood, I think 1961 Beguiled. And what was interesting is that for 1961, the amputation scene is really, really graphic. I mean, it's slicing blood and gore, guts, it's, you almost have to look away. Whereas the most recent one is not at all, you know, and so why, you know, you hear his cries, etc. It's, again, it's an oral cutting, but you don't see it. So I'm just wondering what happens in that moment, thinking about how you're tracking sort of from this modern, postmodern,
yeah,
where the cut is visualized at one point and then kind of disappears, which is the opposite, or maybe it's the same as Tarantino, who goes to the opposite extreme,
yeah,
of you know, the exaggerated or the grotesque. And I'm wondering if one can link it, like, what do we do with this idea of a wound and a wound in film, where any one of us could right now click on whatever device we have and pull up any number of quote-unquote real photographs,
yeah,
of wounds, of,
yeah,
horrible, you know, documentary casualties, war, etc. I mean, there are just more of those images are accessible than ever before and readily available. So what does it mean then to stage a wound,
yeah,
in fiction?
Yeah, I don't know. I could see that as being the answer to the sort of question that I end on with Tarantino, is that this aesthetic has been pushed to its breaking point, but we haven't found anything to replace it. And maybe taking a step back from the graphic is what's needed, because as you say, nothing really shocks anymore. And I think oftentimes we confuse queasiness or squirming with, you know, this modernist shock that would have some sort of aesthetic value. It's ugly and it makes me uncomfortable. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a, you know, a triumph of an artwork. And so maybe a more subtle approach to that, or, you know, as you say, refiguring an earlier amputation, an earlier wound that was almost too graphic to be bearable, that now restraint is a more powerful way to go.
If I can say something, I think here we have to deal with what might be called a basic sadism of the viewer. And just to go back to the way Mario Pras put it, which was convincing for me, he showed that the transformation of Saad's aesthetics of killing people and torturing them, mostly the idea of torture to create pain, if we define sadism as the pleasure we can have watching other people in pain, to Baudelaire. And after was that in Baudelaire and after, you were not just the torturer, but you could also be the victim. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering whether it was not what you were driving at by focusing on the wound in such a way that it feels at times, when you watch many slasher films, gore films, horror movies, you don't really feel it. Once in a while, you do. As in that famous scene in Reservoir Dogs, mm-hmm. that something, and you analyze it so well in your book, because you show why it is so disquieting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this, you have to read the book for that. but don't you think that there is something there that is both ethical, because after all, you may feel not only squeamish, but also opposed to spectacle of a purely sadistic nature, yeah, that will transform, you know, Panem et Circenses. Every time I think about Rome antiquity, you think that, you know, they didn't have television, but every day they could watch Christians being torn apart by beasts and gladiators killing one another. No, we haven't moved that much far, mm-hmm, from that. And so there is the ethical issue, but also the aesthetic problem there. So what is it to show that, to make it into a show, a film, yeah, or a text?
It's interesting. You made me think of two wounds that I discuss at length, or two sort of passages that I'd never thought to sort of put into consolation. One is the Baudelaire, Celle qui est trouée, where there's a wound, a penetrative wound made in the woman's side, and then that becomes the orifice for rape, essentially. And the beginning of Reservoir Dogs, the very first lines of Tarantino's career, are him bragging basically about what a big dick he has, and saying that, like a virgin, that the whole song is about a guy with a really big dick and that it hurts. But it's this, the same kind of bravado. This is, I guess, the modernist bravado of, you know, it's there in Kafka too. You know, like, how do you know my book is good? Because it's really gonna hurt. And you can see in Tarantino, when you look at that sequence in Reservoir, you can see it in Tarantino how much skill it takes to make that work, in part because he can also make violence into pure play. But that has to get added on later. There's the humor in Baudelaire, there's the humor in Kafka, but not quite in the same way. It's interesting too, as you say, that Blessure comes up at all in Baudelaire, and I think that might actually just be a shift in usage over, you know, the last 150, 160 years or longer. And that he tends to be describing sort of open wounds or really violent penetrative wounds, and yet he uses blessure a lot more often than you would expect, and a lot more than, say, Bataille would. Although when Bataille uses it, blessure takes on a sort of spiritual quality that I think is different from the physicality of La Plaie.
I was once thinking of Joyce's play, the only play, Exiles. It ends with the artist, quintessential artist, Richard, saying, I am wounded, a deep wound of doubt, and I don't want my wound to close.
Yeah.
So the wounded artist is really a trope that goes,
yeah,
from
definitely,
decadence to modernism, and you show that very well. Yeah.